Hey everyone, this is John, and this is the Nintendo Show, the best damn Nintendo podcast on the internet. This is going to be an After Dark, and I am solo. We had a bit of a delay recording the Pokemon show, which is the typical first show of every month, but there are five Saturdays in October. We've got a pretty good pattern of posting podcasts every Saturday now. So We decided to delay the Pokemon show a little bit and just get together and do an After Dark, and then Wes and Ryan were both not able to make the recording, so I'm just going to monologue for a while here about some off-topic stuff, probably talk a little bit about games to bookend the episode as well, but I have a lot of comic book stuff and a movie that I wanted to talk about before, you know, we get into the regular show schedule. So before I get things kicked off, I don't have a drink with me. It's still not quite cold enough in Orlando for some hot chocolate or a warm drink like that, but hopefully within the next, you know, month or so, it'll dip down a little bit lower to where it's maybe only breaking into the 70s in the afternoon, high 70s. We'll see. Sometimes we get that sort of weather in November and December. Sometimes it stays really fucking hot. But anyway, I digress. I want to start off with a couple of little news tidbits to get out of the way, since we don't really cover the news until the end of the month. Just some small announcements. We did get the release date for the Pokemon Crown Tundra expansion pass. That one's coming out this month on the 22nd, which is going to be great to jump back into that game. And there has been, you know, rumors about what the size of that particular expansion is going to be. Some speculation that it will end up being a bigger geographical space than the Isle of Armor. That is yet to be seen. We'll see. That will be pretty exciting because I love getting this sort of expanded content in a Pokemon game rather than, you know, a 1.1 version, upgraded version like Ultra Sun, Ultra Moon, something like that. I think this is a preferred way to continue to expand on the game rather than releasing an updated version the next year. And I hope that they keep this going. I hope that the Frost Tundra isn't the end of it. But they had a little video about it a few days ago here, and they showed a lot of legendary hunting. It looks like there's going to be a lot of legendary gathering from all previous versions of the game using the Dynamax and Gigantamax battles, the raid battles. And it also looks like a really cool new raid mode where you're kind of going through a dungeon or a progression of battles, and it looks like you're able to select NPC team members, you know, if you don't have someone who's going to tag team with you for these Dynamax battles. That would be really great if it gives you the option to sort of build a team. Even if you don't have direct control over them, you'll be able to, you know, set up a battle where you're not depending on, you know, some guy who's got a Wobbuffet and hoping that they pick the right move at the right time. But we'll get into a bit more of the nuances of that next week when we do the Pokemon show. We'll still do our ghost rankings, but we'll also talk a bit more about the presentation and the expanded content for the Crown Tundra. And then the other little piece of news that I do want to address this again, maybe on the mini show in a couple of weeks when we're all back together again. It is the announcement of the new Smash Brothers character. It is Steve from Minecraft. Wes has experience with the Minecraft series, so maybe he has an opinion of this. Ryan has probably put more hours into Smash Brothers than either one of me and Wes, so it will be interesting to get his thoughts on having that extra character in there. I'm not sure if Ryan has any experience with Minecraft, but I certainly do not. And this announcement got a big old man eye roll from me. I don't know that this character really fits into the roster of Nintendo characters, and that's really one of the things I like so much about Smash, is you can take all of these Nintendo characters, and even though they're all from very different franchises and different genres, they all seem to fit very well together. And, you know, I think this continues to set an expectation for Smash Brothers as a series to have always this constant one-upmanship, and having this expanding roster that goes to different franchises. And I still think that, you know, on whatever the successor for the Switch is, there's going to be a successor to Smash on that. Maybe they just continue bringing Ultimate over, and they have some sort of licensing deal worked out with all these characters where they can keep on moving Ultimate over and keeping that game as the sort of Smash Brothers platform. But if they have to start over from scratch and make a new one, I don't think we ever see this sort of large roster with these different third-party characters in it all the time anymore. And to me, I thought that would probably be a benefit. Like, I would see that as a positive, to see a more contracted roster and a more focused fighter, maybe with switching up with some unexpected mechanics in the way that really mainstay characters like Mario and Link would work. But anyway, suffice it to say, I'm not super excited for this particular announcement, and I really haven't dabbled in any of the DLC, like expanded character roster for Smash. I haven't purchased any of them, and Smash Brothers was, you know, a platform that I was hoping I would be more into on Switch than I was on Wii U. And I probably have clocked more hours in the Switch version than the Wii U version. But, you know, they had this whole pandemic thing going, so gatherings have been, you know, pretty much non-existent for the past 6 months. So I really haven't clocked any time with the game since then, or since before, you know, the world ended. Anyway, maybe when things get back to a closer resemblance to normal, we'll get back together again and have these game nights where we can play some Smash and maybe experiment with the new characters and stuff. But I wanted to go a little bit off book here, a little bit non-Nintendo, and talk about some of the comics, some of the X-Men comics that have been coming out over the past year. I believe I talked a little bit, probably at the end of last year, about House of X and Powers of X, which was the big, not so much a reboot, but a new direction for the X-Men characters and storylines. So, building off of that, the main author, kind of the driving force behind the X-Men books, is an author by the name of Jonathan Hickman, who I've never really read any of his stuff, but I'm really, you know, I'm generally positive on what has been happening in the X-Books since he has taken over. There's a lot of really intriguing stuff, some really fun moments that have been happening. And, you know, I'm going to talk about the ones I'm more positive on. There's a couple of books that are ongoing right now that I'm not super positive on. But one that I actually do really enjoy is the flagship title. It's just titled X-Men. And the trade paperbacks for these are available. Covers the first 6 issues. And then there's a trade paperback coming out in November that'll cover the next several issues. But the interesting to me most about the X-Men book is that it doesn't really work as modern trade paperback volumes have worked over the past, you know, couple of decades, where you have 6 issues and you kind of like have a storyline that's, you know, confined to 6 issues, sometimes expands a little bit beyond that, but the trade paperback is going to give you a story with a beginning and an end. You'll get some sort of closure or catharsis or something big that will have happened, and then you'll move on to the next thing and the next trade paperback. You know, there are still like storylines that continue over larger issues, but by and large, it's more confined, like serialized storytelling rather than like huge long form ones. And X-Men seems to go back to a, or I guess reinvent, because it's not really going back to like a individual issue thing, but it's a lot of setup. It's setting up a lot of different storylines and obstacles. It's not typical of how trade paperbacks are, how these like storylines work in comics now, where it's, you know, finish one thing, then move on to the next. There's quite a bit going on with all of these different characters. X-Men is an interesting one because it doesn't really have a set like roster. These are the characters you're going to be following in this book, like most of these different titles will have. But there's a lot of Cyclops, Scott Summers, which of course I am always a fan of, and they're all living on Krakoa together, as they did at the end of House of X and Powers of Ten. I think one of the more interesting things to me is sort of the dynamic of the Summers household. Cyclops does a lot of hanging out with his daughter from another universe, Rachel, from the Days of Future Past storyline, as well as Kid Cable, who is a character that was introduced in the Extermination storyline, who will also have his own ongoing series. But they encounter Cyclops and Storm in an early issue encounter this person, this girl, who is from this place called the Vault, which, a little bit of backstory, it reminds me a lot of The World, which was a sort of a dynamic place from when, not Jonathan Hickman, why is his name escaping me? Grant Morrison was writing X-Men and New X-Men, and The World was this place where there's this sort of like a clandestine government agency, the Weapons Plus program, was having like this sort of like compressed time space where time moves faster inside than it does inside, you know, the actual universe. And they would use that to sort of accelerate this human evolution, have this like commingle evolution of mutant humans and machines in order to create these weapons, these biological and mechanical weapons that would help them combat mutant evolution. And it was interesting because you would have like a character that's like Phantom X would be from The World, and you get like these sort of accelerated, evolved characters that would like come back, like enter the actual world, Earth, and have no idea where they were or what was going on. And because you would go into the world, the arena, and time would pass much faster there than it does in the regular world. And they have something like that called the Vault. And they meet this girl who was from there. She disappears, and that's how they kind of become aware of its existence. And it's like inside a master mold, which is another thing that's going on, one of the other storylines that they're continuing from House of X and Powers of Ten, is, you know, you have this continuing threat of Sentinels. So in Powers of Ten, House of X, they send a team that into space in close to Mercury orbit around the sun, and they take out this, I think they called it a mother mold, which is a sentinel factory that builds master molds, which is a sentinel factory that builds actual sentinels. Kind of a weird roundabout thing to do. Have a factory that builds factories. Why not just have your big factory making the sentinels? Neither here nor there. So that gets destroyed, but then they stumble across another master mold that has like the Vault inside of it. And but before we get to that, they also discover this other sort of entity that has a connection with Apocalypse. You find that Apocalypse has some sort of history with Krakoa and these other beings that have an extra-dimensional relationship with Krakoa as well. So they're setting up Apocalypse for some shenanigans there as well. But the one of the really fun things that happens before we get back to the Vault is there is like this kind of one-off story, but they're setting up like these villains for another, perhaps some more shenanigans later. But they're called the Horticulture, and they're these sort of like bio-separatist, like extreme human, like mutant extermination kind of thing, kind of like eco-terrorists, because they're not exclusively against mutants. They're sort of like trying to restore the world to some sort of naturalistic order. But it's really funny because they turn out to be just like these elderly women who are these like eco-separatist group, and they never expected to like when they're investigating the sort of attack on Krakoa, they never expected to see these geriatric women kind of like causing a ruckus on their island. And it's funny because Emma Frost and Cyclops and Sebastian Shaw go out to confront them, and they totally take shots at Emma, like calling her a tart. And there's a series of really fun panels where Emma's just like aghast at the sort of language they're using against them. And Sebastian Shaw tries to turn on his old man charm to kind of like schmooze them into stepping down, and he gets like shot in the face with the sticky gel that incapacitates him. And it's funny because like Scott gets shot with this like silly goo that incapacitates him as well, and like then the, like these super powerful mutants just get taken down by these elderly women because they're totally caught off guard, have no idea what to make of any of this. But then these characters sort of just escape, and you can expect to probably see them again later, and that's probably going to tie into also something that's a bit more complex. So that seems to be the way that Jonathan Hickman is writing this, is that he is taking this sort of series of seemingly unrelated events or villains or happenstance, and it'll probably all tie in together as maybe not all interconnected, but all build toward one thing where they all are at odds with each other. But getting back to the vault. Later on in the trade, in one of the, I think it's issue number 5, they discover the vault underneath this master mold, where you have this extra dimensional space where time moves faster, and decide, okay, we need to figure out what's going on in there, but we can't just like send in a main team. We don't know how long it's going to be gone. So Cyclops decides that, okay, we're going to send, we don't know what's in there. We don't know like the survivability of it. So we're going to send in X-23. You're probably a character that a lot of people are familiar with because of the Logan movie. And they also send in Darwin and Sync. And neither of those characters have really had anything to do for quite some time, probably because they've both been dead. But they got resurrected at, in House of X and Powers of 10, where everybody got resurrected. And like Darwin has like these adaptability powers. You've probably seen his character in what was X-Men First Class, where he puts his head in water and he grows gills. And that's kind of like a rough idea of how his powers work. If he's confronted with a situation where he needs to change in order to continue to live, his body will make that change for him. And Sync, basically, he copies powers of mutants in his proximity. So, he'll get X-23's a highly capable healing factor, and then also Darwin's adaptability. So, Scott Summers decides, like, I'm going to send these three in. You figure out what's going down here, and then come back, report back, and we'll get this all figured out. And he's also sending them in because, they're the. Especially for X-23, and Darwin, the aging process isn't going to be quite as extreme because of her longevity, because of the healing factor, and his longevity because of the adaptability. So they go in, and you cut to months. You don't get to see what happens. They just go in to the vault, and then it closes, and they. You don't hear from them again. But the next panel, Cyclops is kind of like monitoring the vault, and you get the information that three months have passed since he sent them in, and he asks the sort of a computer program, like, okay, so how much time has passed for them? And it has been like 500 years. And he just kind of has this look like, oh shit, what the fuck did we do? So you don't hear from those characters again in this particular trade, but that's something that's a storyline that's definitely going to come back. Like, these characters, they're going to have to figure out, you know, what they're going to, like, how they're going to bring them back and what they're going to be like when they come back. And, you know, there's always, like, the resurrection machine that they have on Krakoa, so they could just, like, bring them back that way. They could, like, make them new bodies and put their consciousness into those bodies. Like, there's a way around that. It'd be a really lazy way to wrap that all up, so I don't think that's what they're going to do. But it is just really fascinating to think about, like, what they could be going through for 500 years and what they could be like when they get back. But my favorite issue in this trade is the sixth one, where it's just all about Mystique and Destiny. And these two characters have been in the X universe for quite some time. Destiny died back in the late 80s and never got resurrected, but Destiny was a precog. She had precognitive powers. She could see the future outcomes of events and how people's lives were going to go, that sort of thing. And when these characters were introduced, they were friends, they were buddies, they were raising Rogue together. Now, the original intention for these characters is they were supposed to be married, and the original idea was that Destiny was Rogue's biological mother, and Mystique was Rogue's biological father. She, you know, was a shapeshifter. She shapeshifted into a man, fathered a child, and then went back to original shape, and they were raising this child together. That sort of thing didn't quite fly in the 70s and the 80s, so they were just friends for quite some time, and that has been retconned now to where they were married, but Rogue still not their biological child. But what's been going on is, you know, when all of the mutants got resurrected, they did not resurrect Destiny, and that does not make Mystique happy. She's pretty fucking pissed about that. But they keep sending Mystique on these suicide missions, and like, yeah, we're going to resurrect Destiny. We're going to do it. Just, you got to do this thing for us first. We got to complete this mission. So they keep on sending her out. And, you know, she dies and gets resurrected, and they send her out, and she dies and gets resurrected. And each time she's like, okay, we're going to do it now, right? We're going to resurrect her now, right? And each time we're like, well, no, we got to do this other thing first. We got to do this first. So she ends up going on this mission, and she finds a Nimrod Sentinel, which is something that, oh, God, like, this thing is fucking deadly. It's like the Sentinel, like a Sentinel from the future kind of thing. And that's something that also hasn't paid off yet. But, you know, she finds this thing, she comes back, and they were like, resurrect her now. Like, okay, well, it wasn't the deal. You didn't complete the mission. Like, I don't give a shit. Bring her back. And they, again, refuse. So you get to the point at the very end of the story where there's a flashback with Mystique and Destiny talking. And, you know, Destiny has some pretty powerful abilities, but you can't always see super far into the future, especially after her own death. But the very last panel, Destiny's like, okay, I can't tell you exactly what's going to happen, but I can tell you that when you get to this point, you just need to remember, bring me back. And then says, like, and if you can't bring me back, then you need to burn the whole place to the ground. And holy shit, they got this, like, mutant dysutopia on this island living all together. And, like, the one person that you don't want sort of in the shadows trying to take the whole thing down is in the shadows ready to take the whole thing down. And it's so good because this is, like, exactly the sort of thing Mystique is good at. Just being an agent of chaos, ready to ruin everything. I'm really looking forward to how that is all going to resolve. another one that's more of a traditional story as opposed to like the kind of all the setup, all the scattershot setup that they were doing in X-Men is Marauders. And Marauders is a really cool team. Is Kitty Pryde, Iceman, Storm, Bishop, Pyro, the original Pyro, who has now been resurrected. And you also get a bit of Emma Frost in there as well. But what's happened here is Kitty Pryde is... Let me back up for a second. In the new X-Men landscape, they're all living on Krakoa. And Krakoa basically has like these portals that are kind of organic based. You need to plant a flower that will grow a portal in all these different places around the world or around the universe. And then you'll be able to enter a gate on from the Krakoa side and exit the gate, you know, wherever it is in the universe that you've placed it. So it's really, it's how they get around most of the time. And only mutants can enter the gates. If you're just a regular human or an alien, you can't use it. You have to be a mutant. And Marauders begins with Kitty Pryde unable to use the gate. And they haven't really addressed why that is the case. There's some speculation that she's not actually a mutant. That is not something that they hint at in the actual book. For all intents and purposes, according to the text of the book, she's still a mutant. It's just they're not sure why she can't use the gate. Maybe it has something to do with her phasing power. I don't know. Maybe they'll address that at some point. So rather than, you know, living on Krakoa where she would just kind of be trapped without a gate to go through, and also she's a little bit bitter about it, she decides to grab a boat and live life on the high seas, going out and, you know, being a pirate, basically rescuing mutants from countries who wouldn't let their mutant citizens get to a gate in order to go to Krakoa. So it's her job to go in there and smuggle people out. And she does this sort of like in a loose alliance with Emma Frost, who invites her to join the Hellfire Club as the Red Queen. And that's something that, you know, I'm a little bit torn on. Kitty Pryde does have this rebellious streak where she would do things unexpected and a bit rash, I guess is the word I'm looking for. But I don't think she would join the Hellfire Club because her first encounter with mutant, with villains was the Hellfire Club and was Emma Frost. So, you know, it's not really like a super uneasy alliance either. It's just kind of like, okay, we're going to work together on this now. So, you know, I think that's a bit of a leap for the character, but the book is pretty fun, you know, on its own right. So I'm willing to overlook that a little bit, but it is really fun to see the two of them sort of undermine Sebastian Shaw, who's the Black King of the Hellfire Club. And so like these power plays that they make in order to just make him look foolish or silly. And they do finally resurrect Shinobi Shaw, who was Sebastian Shaw's son, who was part of a group of new villains. They're calling themselves the Upstarts. And they're kind of like this competition going with them, like between themselves about who could kill the most mutants. And that was way back in the late 80s, early 90s kind of time frame. That's a sort of storyline that kind of petered out. The Upstarts came and they were around for quite some time, but then they kind of went away. And not a whole lot of those villains were ever heard from again, except for now Shinobi Shaw is back. But this is a fun storyline, and it ends on this nice little cliffhanger where it leaves you wondering how they are going to either bring a character, like get them out of trouble, or if they're just going to use the magic resurrection machine to circumvent all of the trouble that they get into. Oh, also the Hellfire Club of Children, who were right around the time that there was the schism back in the late aughts, I think that was. They make a return as well, and they're up to their usual no good. But I think my favorite, or I guess my second favorite book that is going on right now is New Mutants, and it is very tonally different, whereas, you know, Marauders is like a swashbuckling adventure, and New Mutants is more of a comedy. And, you know, they're There's a bunch of characters. Of course, from the New Mutant stories in the past, you get Cannonball and Sunspot, and Rain, Wolvesbane, Danny Moonstar, Illyana, Karma, Jonathan Starsmore, Chamber, and Mondo are there for some reason as well. Doug Ramsey is around for a little bit. But this is New Mutants. They go into space. They catch a ride with the Starjammers in order to find Sam Guthrie, Cannonball, and they're going to give him an option to come back to Krakoa with them. So they go into space and they immediately get into trouble. And I think that the thing I like most about this book is, I never thought I would say this sort of thing, but Sunspot is a really fun character because he's just like this rich, like, self-absorbed goober, and he gets himself into trouble all of the time. He ends up like in space court and sentenced to space jail with the other New Mutants, and Cannonball and his wife slash girlfriend, I'm not exactly sure what their relationship is, have to bail him out. They get like abandoned by the Starjammers. They get marooned. He develops this crush on this character Deathbird, who is the sister of the Empress of the Shi'ar Empire. She's a super powerful, super deadly woman who seems to be unimpressed by his bullshit, but also like the window is there, like the window is open. She doesn't just outright reject him. There's this really funny part where he just kind of like approaches her and starts like bragging about himself. He's like, I'm super rich. I buy small countries. It's not a big deal. And like then she like turns to him like he's like this little gnat. And so like, well, I am royal blood of this noble house. It goes back millennia. We're not rich. We're fucking wealthy. I buy planets and it is a big deal. And he's such like this resilient little cockroach that doesn't really put him off, even though that seems like a pretty harsh like rejection. He thrives on that sort of thing, and I really like the way that he's written in this book, because even though he's just this fucking goober, you really like him. Illyana is also written really well in this book. She's just a fucking badass as always. And yeah, I don't really have too much else to say about this one. It's just like this really good time. It's funny and it doesn't take itself seriously. And it's a nice contrast from the rest of the X books, because you know nothing is really too high stakes. It's just a bunch of friends having fun. But speaking of New Mutants, I went and saw the New Mutants movie, which is out in theaters, such as they are right now. Me and my buddy Hector went one night after work, and we saw it. It was actually pretty nice, because not only was there no one else in the theater except me and him, I don't think there was anyone else in the multiplex except me and him. I think we had the whole fucking place to ourselves, because now we bought tickets, and we went in there. We got concessions. The only other people we saw were employees. So, you know, we had our pick of seats. You know, we just stayed socially distant and all that. So just trying to be as safe as possible, even though we see each other all the time at work. But it was really nice, because we were able to, you know, lean over and make comments about what was happening during the movie without, you know, risking some like disturbing anybody else, because there was nobody else there. But the movie itself, I thought it was pretty good. And you know, there's like I think the inflection matters, because you know, something can be like, yeah, it was pretty good, but as long as you know, it was pretty good. Like I had, you know, decently high expectations for it, because I really like these characters and the particular storyline they were building off in the comics. It wasn't exactly what I expected it would be. Like, I think that it is pitched as a kind of haunted house horror movie, which is a really interesting idea for a superhero or a movie with the characters have superpowers. It wasn't so much a haunted house horror movie. It was more akin to something like Shutter Island in terms of its tone and the sort of scares it was going for. And, you know, that's not exactly a super fair comparison because Shutter Island, directed by, you know, one of the five best living filmmakers right now, Martin Scorsese. But I think that, you know, for what they were going for, I think they pulled it off pretty well. There were some moments that were, you know, not outright terrifying, but pretty freaky. And some tense moments as well. And it's hard to step outside of what I already know about these characters because I know the characters and how their lives play out and kind of like the nature of their characters. I kind of know what's happening when there's supposed to be like a bit of a mystery surrounding their circumstances. I think it was a really interesting sort of low-key movie with the characters who have superpowers, and I really dug all of the characterization. Of course, Dani Moonstar, I think of all the characters, she kind of like had the I guess shallowest arc. She didn't really have the much growth as a character, other than, you know, her being able to deal with her powers. Like her growth was more external rather than overcoming some sort of internal challenge, whereas like all the other characters had all of their like really cool quirks and charms. Like Rain Sinclair, Wolvesbane, was a really great character. They handled her character really well because she has this sort of guilt or shame about her powers, and they portray that really well. Very devoutly religious. One of the really interesting things, and I thought it was handled so well, was in the movie, Dani Moonstar and Wolvesbane engage in a romantic relationship, whereas in the comics it was more of like this sisterly relationship, and they have this telepathic connection. But they decided to take it a romantic direction in the movie, which I think they handled totally fine. They did have a few like awkward teen moments, which I think made sense because they are awkward teens. But there's also the part like after they've kind of not full on started their relationship, but you can tell that there's something happening there, where Rain goes into confession. She's confessing to nobody because there's no one else at this facility with them. Except for Dr. Cecilia Reyes. We'll get to her. But she goes into this confessional, confessing to nobody, and she talks about, like, okay, I sinned this way, and I sinned this way. And she doesn't mention her attraction to this other girl as a sin. And it's a really, like, I think, an important omission. And a really progressive idea that she's allowed to be both religious and attracted to someone of the same sex. And I think that was a really, really important thing that they did there. To make it like not seem like they're doing anything shameful. Like, and then they didn't try to like overly sexualize the relationship. I think that they handled that aspect of it really well. I'd be interested to see what a gay woman's perspective of that would be, to see if they handled that relationship in a dignified way from their perspective. But from my perspective, I thought that, you know, just that, like, that one touch of having like not like Rain feel like she's doing like she's committing a sin against God, I think it was really important for the movie. Ilyana Rasputin was tremendous. She kind of like has this role of like the mean girl, and I think she probably experiences like the most character growth throughout the movie. I think her relationship with everybody, all the other characters, was really great. And yeah, I don't know what else to how else to gush about her performance. Like she was like cruel and nasty and ends up being not such a bad person after all. She goes through a lot of growth to where at the end, you know, she's helping everybody and kicking a lot of butt. I think if like the one major criticism I have about the movie is that when there aren't a lot of action sequences, but when you get like the one big action sequence at the end, there was a lot of, you know, showing a character about to leap into the action, but then you look away from what they're doing. You only get small glimpses of actual like choreographed fighting. And for, you know, a superhero, like a movie with superheroes in it, you do want to see them actually using their powers from time to time. And you want to see them like fighting using their powers. And you get a little bit of it, but you don't nearly get enough of it to really get like that sort of like catharsis from seeing that really well choreographed fight. I think that Cannonball, Sam Guthrie, was portrayed really well as like a yokel country bumpkin who's like dealing with his guilt of a mishap when his powers manifest. Sunspot, I think, was also portrayed really well as this kind of like spoiled rich kid who's also grappling with this guilt of an accident that happened with his when his powers manifest. Like, guilt was a very common theme throughout the movie. Like, it's sort of like dealing with like the guilt and the shame of, you know, having these powers manifest in ways that put other people in danger, and the guilt and the shame that you deal with like when growing up, when you feel like an outsider and like you are awkward and repulsive, and why would anyone ever want to be around you? And that's kind of like the crux of like storylines or books like New Mutants, where you are just children trying to deal with something that's happening to you that you don't feel like happens to anyone else, but you know there are things that everybody goes through. So where was I? Oh, Dr. Cecilia Reyes, kind of like the antagonist of sorts of the film. And she is a character that was a really interesting choice, because they could have just made up a character, but they decided to go with her. And her power is throwing up a force field. And it's, I've only ever seen it displayed in sort of a defensive method, where she like has this involuntary response to where it's like someone like tries to stab her, a force field to go up around her in order to protect her from harm. And in this one, they're also using it as a way to like cage these kids within this medical facility with no one else in it, and kind of like have this visage of like, you are here to learn to control your powers, and after you learn to control your powers, you'll be able to leave and go on to, you know, join a superhero squad like the X-Men, if that's what you want to do. And one of the other criticisms about the movie is that they did a bit of whitewashing when it came to a couple of the characters. Sunspot is a Afro-Brazilian, I think might be the preferred nomenclature. I'm not 100% sure about that, but he is Brazilian, but he is also black in the comics. And he was a Hispanic Brazilian in the movie. Same goes for Cecilia Reyes. She is in the books a black Puerto Rican woman, and in this one she is Hispanic. So you still get I suppose the diversity Hispanic representation, but you know, I can understand why, you know, if you are a black person and looking for that representation on screen, I can see why this would be, you know, a bit uncomfortable. I can I think that the movie stands, you know, on its own merits as a good movie. I just wish that I hope that they did not intentionally say, let's not have these characters be black. You know,
It's not an easy topic for me to tackle. I am not a black person, so I can't see the world entirely from that perspective. I think they would have done better to have the characters represented on screen as they are in the books. Because even though they might not be trying to intentionally whitewash something or have less racial representation for particular groups, I just think they could have done better than that. Anyway, overall, yeah, really, really thought it was a pretty good little movie. So, let's end this monologue by talking about a few games that I've been playing over the past couple of weeks. I finished off Mario 64. I got all 120 stars, so it is 100% complete. And outside of a few kind of frustrating collections of 100 coins, had a pretty good time with it. Overall, very positive on the game. I think that it is a really good example of an N64 game that really holds up against the test of time. And, you know, there's a handful of those, and then, you know, right at the top of our N64 rankings, you know, Mario 64, Ocarina of Time, Majora's Mask, absolutely, Star Fox 64, you know, those are kind of the big four. And Ocarina of Time, Majora's Mask, absolutely stand up over time. Those games are, you know, perfect games that will hold up for a long, long time. Mario 64 holds up almost as well, still holds up really well. You know, you always have like the issues with the camera, you know, on a first attempt, having like the camera move incrementally, not really the best way to go about that, but they eventually figured it out. I think that the game, you know, once you get used to the way Mario moves, I think he feels exactly the way he should. He's got a good weight to him. All of the different jumps are really great additions to the Mario repertoire. There are a couple of levels that are a little bit weak. I don't really particularly like swimming levels. And so some of the later levels, TikTok Clock, Rainbow Ride, I didn't really mind so much. I thought they were pretty good. You know, and I only had a couple of challenges there with the 100 coins, especially in Rainbow Ride, because there is that section where you need to collect the blue coins by doing a wall jump up. I think it's like four or five jumps off the walls. And, you know, the wall jumps definitely improve as the Mario series goes on. You eventually get used to it. But I had this problem where I would practice the wall jump, and if I didn't hit the switch to start gathering the blue coins, I would do it fine. But as soon as I stomped on that switch to activate the blue coins, and I had that timer present where the blue coins would disappear, I would totally choke up. And it took me 7 or 8 tries to finally get up the wall and grab those blue coins. I had to keep on killing myself over and over again. And after a couple of tries, I eventually like just made a beeline for that spot. And if I can't get these blue coins, I'm not going to get the 100 coins in this level. So I might as well just kill myself and try again. But yeah, overall, like there's so many like standout levels, and I really love the way that each of the stars is a brief challenge. You know, you can take your time and explore around to collect coins if you want, but if you just make beelines for these different challenges, then you've collected one in just like 5 or 6 minutes. So it's really briskly paced. It's really cool like that. Bomb on Battlefield, Thwomp's Fortress, Tall Tall Mountain, one of my favorites. I really like that Tall Tall Mountain area. You know, even some like Tiny Huge World is such a neat idea for a level. Yeah, Mario 64 is an all-time classic and worth every minute of your time. I've moved on to Mario Sunshine. I've collected 25 shines there. I was doing 10 stars a day in Mario 64, and there were only a couple of times where I had to like push myself to get that 9th and 10th star. Most of the time I was a little bit ahead of my daily sort of routine. Mario Sunshine, I started out getting 10 shines a day. And then, like, on days, like, my plan was, like, on days that I go to work, I'll only do, like, 5 shines. And I was working today, so I had 20 shines. I was going for 25. And after, you know, playing for a little while, I was like, never mind. I'm doing 5 shines a day from here on out. It takes a lot more time to gather shines than it did stars in Mario 64. I am also starting to think that the jump responsiveness when you are close to a ledge is off. It seems like if I run up right to an edge and press the jump button, I am more likely to fall than I am to make that jump. So I'm having to plan my jumps quite a bit before a ledge. And maybe they want you to rely on the hover with your flood more, but I don't know. I don't think that's like good platforming. Like I should risk it. I should be able to take it right up to the jump or to the ledge and rely that I'm going to be able to make that jump, or at least risk being able to make that jump. But it seems like more often than not, I go right up to the ledge and I press the jump button, but I just end up like not even jumping. He just kind of like tumbles over the ledge. So something's off there. Something's not right. Mario 64, you know, you could get right up to that ledge and make that jump. Something about Mario Sunshine isn't right. There's also a level in the, I think in the bay. I don't know. It was in the hotel, and you had to get the pineapple to feed the Yoshi to get into the attic to drop down into like the swimming pool area and collect the shine there. And there's also the blue coins scattered around, which, you know, I'm of two minds about the blue coins. I think it's kind of cool to have like these extra little collectibles, and they did a really smart thing with like just being able to save and continue the level. I really wish that, you know, they had continued like adopted that philosophy with the shines too. Like collect a shine and then you're able to go around and look for more shines. And if like the level was like closed off to certain areas, so let me look around and look for more blue coins before I choose to exit. Anyway, so you have to drop down to this pool with these Yoshi, but I ended up, I got the Yoshi, and I wanted to go searching around for blue coins because I didn't want to have to go back in there. And I got myself into a situation where I had to abandon the Yoshi in order to get out of a room that I was in, because you can't open doors when you are on Yoshi's back, unless I've totally missed something. When you are on foot, you go up to a door, you press Y, you open it, you leave. When you are on Yoshi's back, I tried doing the same thing and a couple other buttons, and Yoshi was not able to open the door. And as soon as you go through the door, you close it, and Yoshi's left inside. I figure that, okay, I'll just do that. I'll grab another pineapple. I'll go back, and I'll feed it to the egg again and get a different Yoshi. It didn't work out that way. I had to leave the level entirely in order to like go back in, get the pineapple again and get the Yoshi again. And that just reeks of bad design. Like there are blue coins hidden throughout this hotel. Some of them you need Yoshi to get. You shouldn't like end up trapped in a room with a Yoshi and having to leave the level again to reset it. That one needed some more play testing. But I do want to do some positives on Mario Sunshine, because it's not all just pure frustration. There are some really cool things to do in that game as well. I think that, you know, it's a bummer that there is no long jump, but I understand why. There's a lot of controls in there. I think that the slide, the dive, feels really good. I really like jumping around and diving in order to get a lot of speed going. So that's a big positive. I think that the side jump has never felt better in a Mario game than it does in Mario Sunshine. I think you have a really good control over it, much better than 64, certainly. And I can't remember another Mario game where I've been using the side jump as much as I have in Sunshine, which is essential because, again, you also don't have a backflip. You don't have a long jump or a backflip, which are really two essential mechanics in 64 that are not in Sunshine. But because the side jump is so useful, you know, it kind of takes place
the place of that backflip. The spin jump also feels really good to pull off and get you some really great height. So I think that Sunshine is leaps and bounds better feeling than 64. You feel like you're getting more precision with your jumps in most cases. When you get close to that ledge and you get that unresponsiveness from the jump, that's a big hindrance. Also nice to see Yoshi back. Always cool to have him in the mix. And it's just a really pleasant environment to be in Sunshine. So this is this beach resort town, and everything is very beach themed. And you get like your theme park and your like cabana hotel. Like so some really cool ideas for environments. Very vertical as well. I like how they experiment with the verticality. I think it would have behooved them to have like checkpoints or places you could easily get back to. There are a couple of levels, specifically I think it's Rico Bay, where you're able to create platforms for yourself as you go to make it a bit easier to get back to where you were. But there are a few levels where, you know, if you fall, you're going to have to start all the way back from the beginning and work your way back around, which is unfortunate. But I really like the way that they are having you climb things a lot of the time. It feels a lot like Tall Tall Mountain in a lot of places. But yeah, I'm generally, you know, I've never been that big of a Mario Sunshine fan. I only ever played it once on the GameCube and I didn't 100% it. I am going to try to go for that 100%. I do have the strategy guide that I've had for a number of years now on my shelf. So I'll probably be consulting that and using it as kind of a checklist to, you know, mark off the like the blue coins and the shines that I've already found. Well, we'll see. We'll see how this goes. I am going to take this one slower than I did 64. Probably do this in, maybe like 4 weeks as opposed to two. It only took me 2 weeks to get through all of Mario 64, which I understand isn't super fast. Some of my friends and buddies from the Discord group were blasting through it in 2 days. So I did also take a leisurely pace with the 64, but I'm going to take an even more leisurely pace with Sunshine. I think that I'm going to enjoy the game more if I'm not feeling like I have to, you know, get a certain amount of shines so I get through it quickly. This one, I'm just going to let the game be what it is and try to enjoy it on its own merits. And last but not least, to wrap up here, I finished Ori and the Will of the Wisps. Really liked it. Really great Metroid style game. I really enjoyed the platforming. They do a lot with, you know, grappling and gripping onto walls and air dash, and you get a power up that allows you to sort of like it's not the dash. The dash, and it's a launch ability, and it's different from a dash because like it kind of like slow things down. You're able to pick the direction you go rather than like use the dash to continue your momentum forward in the direction you were going. There's a lot of like aerial maneuvering and platforming toward the end there that feels really good. So many different powers you can engage in combat in so many different ways depending on how you want to do it. Lots and lots of collectibles to get. I did not end up 100%ing it. I think I ended just shy of 80%. There are a few of the sort of like timed platforming challenges that are quite difficult. So if you're looking for a fun, challenging platformer, I think that this one really fits the bill. The main like a critical path has, you know, a few like decently challenging areas, but they're generous enough with checkpoints where it doesn't get super frustrating at any given time. When you mess up, you know, you learn something and you kind of adjust the way you approach it the next time. There are only a couple of times when, you know, you're doing an escape sequence, things get really chaotic and you become unsure of where it is you're supposed to go next. But one thing I will say is like those sort of escape sections
are shorter in Will of the Wisp as opposed to what they were in Blind Forest. So, you know, you might mess up a few times, but if you find yourself like messing up in the same place, you know, 3-4 times in a row, you're probably at the end of it. So once you get through that, you're probably set. So it ramps up these escape sequences, like the difficulty ramps up in a really smooth way for something that's so fast paced. I think it was really, really well built. Lots of side quests. I didn't do all the side quests. I think there's still, you know, 3 or 4 more that I could do if I ever went back to it. A lot of fetch quest kind of stuff. And I guess they could have done better, like sort of like tracking your progress with that sort of thing, or pointing you in the right direction for what you want to do next. But, you know, overall, no real complaints about the side quests. A lot of the stuff you just kind of stumble upon solutions for if you're just exploring the game. But yeah, like I'm real positive on Will of the Wisp. I think they took, you know, the best parts of Blind Forest, which was like the acrobatic platforming, and they took some really great elements of something like a Hollow Knight with this sort of melee combat that also requires some precision at times, not nearly quite as precise as something like a Hollow Knight, but sort of in that spirit. And then like just all of the really fun elements of a Metroid, where, you know, you get your power-ups that allows you to access new areas, and that new area will give you a new power-up that will allow you to, you know, interact with, you know, a different part of the game in a new way. Really smartly designed game in terms of like just the way the levels are built and the acrobatic platforming and the types of power-ups you're getting and when. Yeah, really, really, really well-made game. Really, really dug it. But on that note, I think that's going to do it for me tonight. In about a week, we'll be back with the Pokemon show, and we'll talk more about the Frost Tundra update, get the other guys' opinions on that, and we'll talk about the ghosts, and we'll rank them. That's it. That's the end. Till next time.